Welcome to Analyzing Trends. Here is the simple thought I cannot shake. 2025 did not give us a clean crisis followed by a clean recovery. It taught us that the plot twist is the plot. The instability has moved from headline to background. It hums. Think of the interwar years or the late 70s. The mood is not panic. It is pressure. We even reached for new words to name it. Adam Tooze called it polycrisis. Collins went with permacrisis. Useful labels, but the shift is more practical than poetic. Disruption has become an operating condition. You can hear it in the numbers and the habits. Fewer people believe divisions can be bridged. Workplaces promise flexibility, then pull it back. Cities add sensors faster than they add consent. Synthetic media moves from novelty to routine. The public adjusts. People stop waiting for the turn and start building workarounds. So our question today is not when we return to normal. It is how we design and behave when pressure is the baseline. What do trust, proof, and redress look like when they are not slogans but requirements?
I feel it in ordinary life, not just in history books. The data points line up with what people say. Only about a third of Americans now believe the country can bridge its divisions, which tells you why patience is wearing out. Therapy wait lists keep stretching. Colleagues talk more about coping than fixing. In my cohort, people stopped saying when things get back to normal. They plan for the load they have. You can see the pivot in housing. About 30% of US households are one person now, and many of my friends have moved from the ownership script to durable renting. They build wealth around flexibility, not mortgages. They budget for smaller units and shorter leases because waiting for a policy rescue feels like a bad bet. It is workarounds instead of promises, and that has become the default.
Adaptation is the tell. History gives us patterns for this. In long stretches of uncertainty, people scale back their bets on the future. You can see early signs now. The US birth rate sits near historic lows, roughly 1.6 children per parent. Geographic mobility has fallen to levels we once associated with the mid-20th century. Households are less willing to uproot, even when a move might raise income. Retirement behavior echoes that caution. Contributions wobble with market swings and caregiving costs, and many workers carry far less cushion than planners recommend. When systems deliver uncertainty as the main product, planning feels like a luxury. People optimize for today and protect energy rather than invest in a story they do not trust.
Trust sits at the center of this. The decline is not just cynicism. It looks rational when people watch institutions say one thing and do another. Companies pledged remote work, then reinstated mandatory office days. Corporate filings used to trumpet diversity, equity, and inclusion. The share explicitly using that language fell by roughly 60% in a year, even as many rebranded the work under safer labels. Voters tell pollsters that only about a third believe the country can bridge its divisions. Those are mixed signals at scale. Fukuyama's idea of a low-trust equilibrium is useful, but I keep wondering if we have drifted into something thinner. If people assume reversals are normal, they will not extend credit. A trust rebuild has to look different in that environment. It needs proof attached to claims, timelines attached to reforms, and consequence when commitments slip. Otherwise, the rational response is to keep your distance and plan around the gap.
I think we have slipped into a different chapter. 2020 was a shared crisis with a mostly shared response, at least for a time. In 2025, the crises feel local and the responses feel splintered. There is no common frame to hold them. Polling shows only about a third of Americans believe we can bridge our divides, which helps explain why a shared narrative is hard to sustain. Media diets diverge, synthetic content circulates, And even basic facts arrive in different wrappers. It is not just that we disagree. We no longer agree on the story we are living through.
That is exactly what the data and the diaries point to. Adaptation without hope. People are getting skilled at living inside systems they do not expect to repair. You see it in the growth of solo households, in the shift from ownership goals to flexible renting, in the quiet recalibration of careers around care rather than ladders. It is not waiting for the turn. It is building a workable life inside the pressure and treating that as normal. The smart move for 2026 is to meet people there with proof, consent, and clear routes to redress, because that is what a low-trust equilibrium asks for.
Let us talk about power that would have sounded like fiction a few years ago. In October, the Pentagon confirmed it accepted a $130 million private gift from Timothy Mellon to cover military pay during a shutdown, using what it calls General Gift Acceptance Authority. Budget lawyers immediately raised Anti-Deficiency Act questions. That is not a trivia item. It is a line crossed in public. History gives us analogues, Renaissance city-states underwritten by banking families, charter companies that blurred the line between private capital and public force. Those were explicit plutocracies. We described them as such. Today, the rhetoric is populist, while the financing looks like patronage. The style says people. The ledger says patrons. Which leaves us with a clearer question for 2026. If private wealth can step into core state functions on demand, what does legitimacy require? Disclosure alone will not do it. We need decision records that link funding to outcomes and a visible path for contesting those outcomes. Otherwise, power may be legible and still not governable.
The symbolism matters, but the math is what makes it plain. $130 million works out to roughly $100 per active duty service member. Military pay and benefits sit in the hundreds of billions. This gift did not fix a budget problem. It demonstrated the capacity to fix one. The pattern is broader. Elon Musk's political giving in the last cycle was roughly $274 million. Total presidential spending reached into the billions. The signal is performative state replacement. These donors are not asking to govern. They are reminding the public that they could, if they chose to. And that reminder reshapes expectations about who solves what when government stalls.
That expectation is the real shift. If people start to assume a billionaire will step in whenever government stalls, we are not filling gaps. We are creating a vacuum. It looks like anarcho-capitalism with a ceremonial state attached. The agencies remain, but the public begins to see them as sidekicks who call for help when the real power arrives. I keep asking whether this is replacement or capture. Either way, legitimacy drains the same way. If outcomes hinge on private discretion, the rules feel provisional and the consent of the governed becomes a courtesy rather than a constraint. The corrective in 2026 is simple to say and hard to do. Build decision processes where public money, public authority, and public recourse are visible in the same frame, so private capacity does not quietly become public policy.
We see that pattern again and again. Working-class voters applaud candidates financed by billionaire donors, even when the policy mix means thinner services and higher local burdens. The cultural story carries the day. Anti-elite. Drain the swamp. It overwhelms the material ledger. Thomas Frank asked the Kansas question 2 decades ago. The arithmetic today just has more zeros. Disclosure does not shift it much because people already know who is paying. What they do not feel is agency. Until there is a credible link between public input and public outcome, the cultural signal will keep beating the balance sheet.
The transparency fixes have hit their ceiling. Campaign finance disclosures are public. People know who is spending what. The issue is not missing information, It is missing agency. Voters see the numbers and do not believe their choices can alter the outcome, so they tune out or vote for the story that feels truer than the spreadsheet. That is not ignorance, it is fatigue at scale. If we want transparency to matter again, it has to travel with levers people can pull and consequences they can see.
It is not uniquely American. Italy under Berlusconi, Thailand under Thaksin, Brexit backers in the UK. The choreography repeats. Wealthy figures promise to clean out corruption and then redirect the flow through their channels. What feels distinct in the United States is that many of our protagonists do not need to run. They fund the office holder, steer the ecosystem around the office, and shape outcomes from just off stage. That is why disclosure alone feels thin. The line of accountability gets bent before it reaches the ballot.
Then perhaps we should stop treating populism as the cure for plutocracy. It may be its perfected stage. If money can script the cast, underwrite the scene, and cue the applause, the label on the marquee matters less than the business model behind it. Which suggests a harder pivot for us in 2026. Instead of waiting for reform to arrive from within this arrangement, act on the assumption that this is the arrangement. Build counterweights that do not depend on goodwill. Tie authority to auditable outcomes. Give people levers they can pull and appeals they can file. If the system will not rename itself, we can at least rebalance how it operates.
I see those fractures up close, and they are not abstract. My own circle went from one group chat to a scatter of Discord servers and niche podcasts. Same age, same city, similar jobs, but the feeds are different and the moral frames are different. It is less about a single policy fight and more about incompatible sources and values. The polling lines up with what that feels like. Only about 1 in 3 Americans now believes we can bridge our divisions. Gen Z is splitting internally as well. Young men cluster toward conservative identity projects, while young women cluster toward progressive solidarity, which means a single message to the generation misses both publics at once. You can hear the break in the media diet. Some friends get their news from institutional outlets and activist networks. Others follow influencers, streamers, and religious communities. We are not just disagreeing. We are not even starting from the same set of facts to disagree about.
Generational splits are not new. The difference now is the collapse of a common channel. In the 60s, people argued over the same 3 nightly newscasts and a handful of national papers. Today, the starting points do not overlap. Feeds are tailored. Private groups replace public squares. Even the visuals are unstable because synthetic images and voices circulate as easily as the real ones. Without shared inputs, you cannot check where you disagree. You talk past each other because you are not speaking the same language. That is why provenance and basic media forensics are not niche skills anymore. They are the price of admission to a conversation that hopes to be real.
This is not a phase of finding yourself. Gen Z's identity work happened during lockdowns on platforms tuned for escalation. The pattern shows up in the research. Edelman's Gen Z lab describes a widening split, with young men clustering around conservative identity communities and young women moving toward progressive networks. Information sources diverge at the same time. Many young men spend more time with long-form podcasts, streamers, and influencer ecosystems. Many young women rely more on institutional media, activist channels, and mutual aid networks. The result is not simple diversity. It is incommensurable worldviews that do not share premises and have little incentive to reconcile. In that environment, a single message to Gen Z misses both audiences, and attempts at bridge building feel less like dialogue and more like translation without a dictionary.
Gender is where the current splits run hottest. The research flags a sharp rise in anti-feminist rhetoric and a kind of performative nihilism among some young men, with parallel moves toward protective solidarity and selective separation among many young women. The historical echo is the 1970s when parts of the feminist movement stepped back from mainstream institutions. The difference now is symmetry. It is mutual withdrawal and mutual suspicion, amplified by feeds that reward outrage and by communities that rarely overlap. That is why the same headline lands as proof of decay in one network and proof of progress in another.
That fragmentation makes organizing brittle. Workplace campaigns stall because the shared language that used to hold a coalition together is not there. You see it in membership groups that splinter over media cues rather than material demands. Party politics mirrors the same pattern. Factions multiply inside both camps, each with its own influences and litmus tests. Institutions that depend on broad coalitions run into design limits. They were built for big tents and common platforms. What they face now is identity-first micro-publics that do not recognize a common center, which turns every negotiation into parallel monologues. The practical effect is fewer durable wins, more performative peaks, and a steady loss of capacity in the places where coordination used to live.
Solo living is not only a rent story, it is a posture. If your feeds feel volatile, you narrow the circle you let into your home and sometimes into your life. The numbers show how common that has become. About 30% of US households are one person, up from 13% in 1960. Among households led by people 50 and older, roughly 36% are single person. That choice can be protective and rational in a low-trust environment. It also sets a ceiling on connection. We are social creatures. Cities that ignore that reality will build private efficiency and public loneliness. The practical link is clear. Plan for individuals with ADUs, micro units, and flexible leases. Then pair that with third places that make contact safe and ordinary. If people live alone and work in hybrid patterns, they still need somewhere to meet the rest of the city.
Cities are full of people living alone, working alone, and scrolling inside customized feeds. Each person sits in a private media climate. If we allow third places to fade, there is no routine venue for safe contact across difference. Cafes, branch libraries, co-ops, and trains do quiet civic work. They supply small talk, eye contact, and shared rules. That is where a city rebuilds common ground without a lecture. The numbers point the same way, with roughly 30% of households now single person. Planning for connection is not optional. It is basic service design.
The same atomization that shapes how we live also shapes how violence organizes. Lone wolf does not match the reality anymore. Most offenders are connected, even if the ties are thin and mostly online. Research maps youth-to-youth recruitment in gaming spaces and short video loops with timelines that compress from years to weeks. After a high-profile incident, you can watch the copycat curve rise inside the same forums and channels that spread the outrage. Which network you inhabit matters more than a survey ideology. The path is less transformation from a stable baseline and more recruitment from alienation. People feel outside the circle, then find a script, an audience, and a visual grammar that makes action feel attainable. That is why media hygiene and local prevention work belong together. You need the digital forensics and the neighborhood relationships to interrupt the loop.
And you can see how that plays out on the ground. The tempo is the tell. After a high-profile incident, the same forums light up with tutorials, maps, and memes that script the next move. It is less ideology than choreography. That is why prevention has to live where the choreography starts. In gaming guilds, school counseling teams, and community spaces that notice when a young person's world narrows to a single story. Platforms can help by throttling virality during acute spikes and by giving moderators fast lanes to escalate credible threats. schools and cities can stand up behavioural threat assessment teams that pair clinicians and community leaders, not just police. Families and peers need simple questions and a number to call when someone is rehearsing harm on camera. The other half is proof. If a platform removes a network, publish the pattern so local actors know what to watch next. If a city intervenes early, show what changed so people believe intervention works. That combination, slowing the choreography online and widening the circle offline, is how you interrupt recruitment from alienation without turning every feed into a speech fight.
It's a bleak picture, but the trend lines don't lie. So if we're tracking divides, let's talk work, because the reset was not, let's be honest, universal. Angela, what are you seeing in your own circles?
It was never universal. The split is leverage. Tenured faculty, senior managers, and some tech roles kept hybrid and kept output. Adjuncts, retail staff, and hospital workers never had that option. Women and caregivers used remote time to cover care without sacrificing performance, then ran into return-to-office policies that restored a presence culture. The filings tell the same story. Use of diversity, equity, and inclusion in S&P 500 annual reports dropped by about 60%, often relabeled as culture or engagement. Abroad, the floor is higher. Scotland's four-day-week pilots held service across dozens of organisations while lowering stress, and Spain now grants single parents the full 32 weeks of paid leave. In the US, the leading proposal caps eligibility around $96,000 and covers up to 25% of wages for 6 to 12 weeks, a class filter written into statute. The micro effect is quiet and costly. People stay but pull back, less mentoring, fewer stretch projects, thinner loyalty where presence beats results. The fix for 2026 is pragmatic and measurable. Tie advancement to documented output, protect a right to request flexibility with real anti-retaliation teeth, and publish pay equity and promotion velocity quarterly so trust rests on proof, not promises.
The deeper split is simple. In some places, care and flexibility are rights. Here they are perks that can be revoked. When the floor is thin, employers fill the gap with policy by memo. That is why the reset often shows up as return to office rather than redesign of work. Presence stands in for proof. Badges and seats replace outcomes and care. Which brings us to your point, Angela. When RTO becomes the default lever, who pays the hidden costs and what does the evidence say about how it lands?
Return to office is a gender trap. Remote work did not cut output. It reallocated commute time to caregiving, mostly for women. RTO assumes someone else is covering care, which usually means women again. The World Economic Forum still puts global parity more than a century away, and with rollbacks and childcare gaps, even that looks optimistic. I want to be hopeful, but I am not planning my daughter's future on a timetable that keeps slipping.
It is a class divide as well. Professional women captured most of the flexibility gains. Working class women, especially Black and Latina workers in frontline roles, rarely had remote options to begin with. So the fight shows up as gender in headlines, but the underlying pattern is class and race. If your job was always in a store, a hospital, or a warehouse, there was nothing to claw back. The reset rewarded the people who already had leverage and left everyone else inside the old rules.
2025 turned the quiet quit into a quiet crack, not a walkout, a hairline fracture that widened across the year. People stayed, did the job, and stopped donating the extras that keep institutions healthy. Fewer mentors, fewer stretch projects, less institutional memory passed along. The dashboards looked fine until the teams stopped flexing. You can see the downstream risk in the demographics. The US fertility rate sits near a record low. Across OECD countries, willingness to have children rises with paid leave, flexibility, and affordable care. When work narrows and care is unsupported, people postpone or opt out. Shrinking the space for family life shrinks the society.
Then the future of flexibility may be a premium, not a public good. Those with leverage by time and choice. Everyone else is told to cope. That is not a reset. It is a split dressed up as policy.
I am realistically hopeful. Some people will keep real flexibility because they can command it. For most, the play is endurance. It is running to stand still.
You can hear the split at work. You can also see it in the streets we share.
Walk any big city and the hardware is obvious. Smart lights, bike counters, air monitors. What is not obvious is the contract. Most residents cannot tell you who owns the data, how long it is kept, or how to fix an error tied to their address. It feels like a city that measures everyone without looping anyone in. The sensing is getting better. Machine learning improves some air sensors, and independent audits catch emissions undercounts that once slid by. Governance has not kept pace. Retention windows are rarely stated in plain language. Appeals are ad hoc. Interfaces assume phones and families when roughly a third of households are single, and many older adults are not app first. A smart network still fails the people who need help most if consent and redress are not part of the design.
In the right hands, this stack is a public good. The same sensors that count bikes can target street safety where injuries cluster. Air monitors can guide asthma interventions block by block. Real-time feeds can move buses where demand actually is. But tools are not neutral. The incentives decide whether they power cleaner air and fairer transit, or drift into gentrification modeling and predictive policing. Urban tech runs on an optimism and pessimism toggle. Who holds the keys, who sets retention rules, and who gets recourse determines which way the switch flips. The fix is governance that arrives with the hardware, consent before collection, clear windows for data life, and appeals people can use without a lawyer.
And on emissions, the pattern is measurable. The average US city undercounts its greenhouse gases by about 20%. When you compare self-reported inventories to the Vulcan model that is validated against atmospheric data, that is not a rounding error, it is a policy problem. Independent work led by Kevin Gurney found 18.3% underreporting on average across 48 cities, with some places missing by far more, which means dashboards often measure appearances while the atmosphere records reality. James Scott would call it legibility for show. The fix is to pair sensing with independent inventories and an appeals process people recognize, so the numbers become tools rather than slogans.
Facial recognition is the same pattern. Cities like San Francisco and Boston barred police use. Private actors kept going. Retailers, landlords, arenas. Federal agencies can still run their own systems regardless of local bans. On paper, that looks like opt-in governance. In practice, the power sits with whoever owns the cameras and the contracts. The remedy has to be jurisdiction that follows the data, not just the department. If a city bans police use, it should also regulate private deployment in public-facing spaces and require disclosure, retention limits, and a working appeal for misidentification. Otherwise, the policy lives on paper while the technology runs the street.
There is no clean trade-off here. City-scale sensing makes real work possible on floods, heat islands, and transit reliability. The same hardware is a surveillance surface. We are back to the privacy versus security dilemma, only now with more dashboards and more data brokers in the loop. The practical test for 2026 is simple. Collect only what you need. Tell people why you are collecting it. Set short retention windows. Give residents a way to see, correct, and contest records tied to their location. If those guardrails are present, adaptation can proceed without turning public space into a permanent scam.
This is not just local. India's Aadhaar system, China's social credit pilots across more than 60 cities, with participation still limited, and Kenya's M-Pesa backbone, serving about 97% of households, show what full-stack civic tech looks like when adoption outruns restraint. They are not behind, they are ahead, on integration, under privacy tolerances shaped by legal frameworks, cultural norms, and developmental priorities. US cities are watching and selectively emulating pieces of these models. That makes governance design urgent. If we borrow the efficiency without importing consent, clear retention limits, and real avenues for recourse, we will inherit the risks without the safeguards.
It collides with solo society in very practical ways. When more than 30% of households are single person, sensor frameworks built around family units misread the city. Single adults show up as inefficiencies or blanks. Among households led by people 50 and older, roughly 36% are single person, which means app-first interfaces and account-linked services can exclude the very residents most likely to need support. We saw one counterexample in New York's rollout of about 900 ELIQ companions for seniors, where 95% reported the devices helped with loneliness. But the broader pattern is clear. If data models assume families and smartphones, solos and older adults fall out of view. Designing for individuals and accessibility is not a feature request, it is the use case.
And they are often hard on the eyes. Cables, camera pods, charging blocks, streets tuned to be machine-readable rather than human-pleasant. Jane Jacobs, Christopher Alexander, Jan Gale all argued for delight, surprise, and contact at eye level. A dashboard can optimize flows. It cannot measure the feel of a shaded bench, a storefront that invites loitering, or a corner where strangers talk. If the city forgets that, it will be efficient and empty at the same time.
That is the heart of the smart dumb problem we mapped in the 2025 Trend Themes work. Cities are optimizing what they can count, not what makes them livable. Consent, retention limits, and a right to appeal only matter if residents know to ask and can use them without a lawyer. Most people do not. So the tech moves fast, the governance lags, and public space gets built for dashboards rather than daily life. The fix is civic literacy and simple defaults. Ask before you sense, publish how long you keep the data, and give everyone a clear way to correct the record.
Let us end on method, because the map matters as much as the terrain. Cultural foresight treats trends as signals inside larger architectures. We start by pairing story with statistic. If a narrative does not line up with numbers, we keep digging. Then we look for contradictions. Retreat in language with persistence in practice, or vice versa, tells you adaptation is underway. We set early warning signals you can actually monitor. Election filings for donor concentration. City inventories against independent emissions models. Provenance adoption in newsrooms and campaign toolchains. And we keep a running sheet of knowns and unknowns so we are honest about what is clear and what is still moving. The point is not prediction. It is disciplined noticing that leads to choices you can make now.
A real foresight practice cannot chase headlines. It has to track the drivers that do not swing with every news cycle. For us, that means calibrating to three tests that show up across the research: proof, consent, and belonging. Treat trust like infrastructure with claims you can verify. Build opt-in governance so collection and use are choices, not assumptions. Design for belonging as a system goal so people are not left navigating alone. When those three are present, the signals make sense and the next moves are clear.
Right. The work is to surface the meta-narratives before they harden. Institutions do not fail with fanfare. They thin out quietly and then give way. At the same time, small counterweights keep appearing. mutual aid groups that did not dissolve after the pandemic, participatory budgeting that moves real money in a few cities, open source governance projects that publish rules and code together so anyone can audit them. None of this is grand yet, but it is direction. Cultural foresight lives in that overlap, noticing where authority is eroding and where credible replacements are being built, then turning those observations into choices you can make now.
You have to audit your own priors. The knowns and unknowns we lay out for each trend are not a stylistic flourish. They are a discipline. Say what the evidence supports. Say what is still moving. Name the blind spots. That is how you keep from mistaking a headline for a driver or a hunch for a pattern. It is also how you invite correction from people closer to the ground. We do not need omniscience in foresight. We need honesty about the limits of what we know and a clear plan to learn more.
We end where our updated analysis points. The 10 trends are not separate stories. They are facets of one transformation. The old institutional order is not collapsing in a single moment. It is dissolving into something we cannot fully see yet. That is the sober part. The practical part is that we are not on the sidelines. We can choose what carries forward. Treat trust like infrastructure. Ship-proof with claims. Put consent before collection. Design belonging into work, cities, and media. If we do that in small, durable ways, the next architecture will not arrive by accident. It will arrive because we built enough of it in time.
That is why people cling to workarounds. They are trying to stay solid in a liquid world. And there is a harder conversation we mostly avoid. What if some systems are no longer fixable at the speed they fail? Campaign finance reforms keep proving the point. Close one channel and the money moves to another. If the mechanism defeats the repair, then the honest option may be replacement, not patching. Few want to say that out loud because replacement sounds radical. But if we keep aiming repairs at structures that root around them, we are performing hope rather than producing change.
There is one lens that helps read the spikes. In behavioral science, an extinction burst is the flare of a behavior that has stopped being rewarded. It surges before it fades. You can see versions of that across this analysis. The sharp rise in deepfake output when provenance tools begin to spread. The hard push for return to office after hybrid proves productive. The loud performative gifts and record checks when formal legitimacy is thinning. The scramble to rename DEI once explicit commitments start to carry political costs. None of these surges guarantee collapse. They can be the last loud attempts to preserve an old equilibrium. The caution is simple. Do not mistake an extinction burst for a durable trend or a final victory. Track three things: how long the spike lasts, how costly it is to sustain, how much it spills over into adjacent systems. If the spike burns hot and short, with rising cost and little spillover, you are likely watching a behavior on its way out. If it recurs with lower cost and wider spill, you are watching the new normal form in front of you.
We also skew our lens to the global north when the demographic engine sits elsewhere. The median age across Africa is under 20, which means the next wave of workers, creators, and voters will not share our legacy constraints. Tech adoption there leapfrogs past landlines and branch banking into mobile payments and platform services. Governance tends to be pragmatic and experimental rather than idealized. Climate migration will force those realities into northern politics and labor markets at a scale we have not planned for. If foresight is honest, it treats the global south as the reference case, not a footnote.
Meaning sits beneath the material. Durkheim's anomy was not only rulelessness, it was the hollowing out of purpose. You can see the search fill the gaps. Some people turn to wellness and self-optimization. Some drift into conspiracies that offer a simple villain and a sense of belonging. Others reach for revived traditions or new spiritual hybrids because they need language for awe and grief that markets and dashboards cannot supply. If institutions cannot offer a shared account of why we are here together, people will build private ones. The task for 2026 is to make public life feel meaningful again in small, credible ways. Spaces where service is seen. Processes where fairness is visible. Stories that connect effort to outcome. Otherwise, the ache to re-enchant will keep finding outlets that are powerful, polarizing, and easily gamed.
My honest read on 2026 is more of the same, but quicker. Private wealth stepping into public roles whenever government stalls. A Gen Z that behaves like multiple publics, not one generation. Solo living rising and becoming a planning variable, not a lifestyle footnote. Synthetic media woven into everyday politics and commerce. Cities getting better at measuring and still missing what makes places livable. And there will be a backlash we did not model. That is how breaks happen now. A sudden court fight that resets a rule. A platform policy that triggers an exodus. A local referendum that rewires a city's data governance. The point is not to predict the spike. It is to harden for it. Shipproof with claims. Collect with consent. Design for belonging. And keep real levers of recourse within reach. That is how we stay steady when the pace picks up.
That's as good a place as any to end. Angela, always a pleasure. Dark conversation, but somehow energizing.
Definitely, Simon. Listeners, you can read the full updated report at analyzingtrends.com.
Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back soon. Until then, stay adaptable and stay curious.